Yeah, so anyway, open discussion, if there is any. Outside of as an illusion, it has no other existence. It is just an illusion, yeah? So, like the any illusion, like the Mulalaya illusion, mm-hmm. I kind of draw it. So the lines are there and all of that's there, and it creates an illusion. But we know in actual fact it is an illusion and those two lines are equal. Mm-hmm. But the illusion itself is just an illusion, mm-hmm. and it doesn't exist in any other way. Yeah, that's all it is. It has its effect as an illusion. Whereas if something is like an illusion, yeah, if something is illusion-like, then it has qualities in common with an illusion, but it's not an illusion. It exists in another way. So the illusion-like is a way of understanding this phrase doesn't exist in the way that it appears. Yes, yeah, it is. Like it's the idea, the feeling or the perception that the sun is going around the earth is an illusion, yeah? Not rather than being illusion-like. But the sun, the earth and its relationship are not an illusion. There they are. Yeah? Yeah? Something that's illusion-like but is not an illusion, the way we exist. The way we exist is illusion-like, but we're not illusions. Mm-hmm. Here we are. Yeah.
Okay.
It's like here, exactly, i.e. the absence of inherent existence doesn't mean non-existence.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah?
So that's like,
and also there's another, from a philosophical point of view. If from a philosophical point of view you postulate that everything is an illusion through and through and through, it's all illusion, then there's no possibility of ever getting... Yeah. If it was all a total illusion, then liberation or insight into its actual nature would be impossible. Now, going back to that Thomas Metzinger's transparency, if everything were an illusion, such would the cosmic transparency be that we'd have no chance of ever realising it into Matrix territory. But even in the Matrix, they get to realise it, don't they? Do you know what I mean? It's like that. It's fun. So, yeah, is that helping distinguish between illusion and illusion-like? Yeah. The Matrix.
The Matrix, yeah.
I think it's a very good one.
When you said
I was... In fact, when I arrived on Friday, and they were all watching, the Jenny and the volunteers were watching The Matrix, and they came and gave me some soup, and they said, we're 20 minutes into The Matrix. Come and join us. And I said, well, no, because I've got to unpack. And if I want to watch it, and I do like watching it, then I want to watch it all. I don't want to go in 20 minutes in. But yeah, no, I think if you think of Buddhist philosophy, particularly emptiness and emptiness yoga and the view, you know, the Buddhist view about, well, what's ultimate reality looking like, I haven't read into the back pages, but my guess is the people who made the film will be influenced in one way or another by Buddhist philosophy. Yeah. I put money on it, but I've never looked to check it out. But yeah, it's so on the money in some areas in terms of its similarities. That's a hard one too, because it is hard. First of all, you think, behind the appearance there's some kind of transcendental reality. It's a dependent reality.
It
won't have any inherent existence.
And it's dependent on
all the causes and conditions that give rise to mental continuums and that mental continuums depend upon.
Yeah.
I think with the one that Lynn's talking about, and I was getting on to, it's like going back to the line in the Heart Sutra. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. That's a relationship of identity. Yeah, form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form. So the two are like that. They're inseparable.
Reality.
It is a reality, but it's dependent. Reality is itself dependent.
Yeah.
It's a causal network in which everything is dependent on everything else. It's not as if dependent reality is here, and this is dependent on another reality over here. It's all in here. That's only a part of it. All of it. The mental continuum, like the mental continuum we're all enjoying at the moment, is dependent on having been born, being alive, mm-hmm. and having five senses, mental consciousness, a brain and a body that's all dependent on. And then our perception of the world, you remember what we were saying about the gong? It's not just that we're inventing or making up the gong moment by moment. It is dependent on our perception of it, given our structure, and how it appears is also dependent. Our perception of that is dependent on the way it impacts our five senses and mental consciousness. There is a dependency, but resist the idea of just reducing it, saying, oh, it's just dependent on that. There's all these other factors. Our understanding of the potential, our perception of the potential, our experience of the potential is dependent on all these other factors. So that, it's like emptiness, the emptiness of inherent existence. When we come at it the way we've been coming at it, it's appreciating it as the absence of something, yeah? So then it's very tempting to think, well, if it's the absence of this, if the emptiness is the absence of all these things, then emptiness starts to look like nothingness. But it's not nothingness, because in the Latin scholars had a word for it, and they called it a plenum void. So if you bring to mind a void, yeah, but it's absolutely pregnant with possibility, with infinite possibility, yeah, and it manifests when we make a decision, we create the causes and conditions for it to go off that way, yeah. Another way of looking at it, which is very good, bearing in mind that all of these kind of constructions and forms of words are like fingers pointing at the moon, because it's ultimately ineffable. We're never going to get to a final description, in my opinion. We're all just gesturing. Any analogy in the end will break down because it's an analogy kind of thing. But one way of looking at it, which comes sort of out of the Mahamudra and Dzogchen traditions, and so a little bit out of the Jnanampa, it's to say, well, appearance and emptiness are one and the same, in the same way that emptiness and form and emptiness. So you have the infinite potential. Yeah. It's not that nothing exists. There's no inherently existing non-existence. Right. There's no inherently existing. Not. It's a relative term. Mm-hmm. Existent or non-existent, relative to what? Yeah. How do we know about the infinite potential? Because it appears like this. But it's not like the potential's behind the appearance. This is how it is. This is how it manifests. They're not two separate things. So are they one? Well, no, not really. They're at least not two. But you can have two conceptual isolates of the one object. Do you see how it never quite gets there? Because that one's ineffable. Does that make sense? There's an overlap, because you'll find Dzogchen Mahamudra practices really very similar to Zen. The pinnacle practices are often very similar. So if I take you back to one that I did use earlier in the week, which was the Song of Realization of the First Sokni Rinpoche. Don't wander, place mindfulness on guard. Along the road of distraction, Mara lies in ambush. Mara is the mind, clinging to like and dislike. So look into the essence of this magic, free from dualistic fixation. realize that your mind is unfabricated, primal purity. There is no Buddha elsewhere. Look at your own face. And one of the most famous koans in Zen Buddhism is, what is your original face? So what do you mean? Sit. Realize it. What's your original face? Well, what am I supposed to do? Realize your original face. Oh, but I can't. Why can't you? You know, the dialogue will go on like that. They won't let you off the hook. As another Lama Lena, who's a very good living female practitioner of Dzogchen, remarkable woman, as she would say at this point, you can't think your way out of this one. Try as you might, you can't think your way out of this one. Yeah. So, there is no Buddha elsewhere. Look at your own face. There's nothing else to search for. Rest in your own place. Non-meditation is spontaneous perfection. So capture the royal seat. Meditation, non-meditation. What's the best meditation? Non-meditation. Is non-meditation not meditation? No. See? You begin to see what's happening there. That's how koans work, basically. There's lots of, and then Western philosophers get very, very tied up. They'll have long arguments about, is this pushing reason so far that it breaks down? Or is it pushing reason so far that there's, you know, some other higher faculty that sees something that's beyond words? And then they'll get all... And people in the Buddhist tradition are just laughing. They're saying they'll go on forever that way. Because it's all, the emphasis is all back on realization. And realization, whether it's through gnosis, poesis, experience. You know, a lot of the Zen tradition's good because there's a lot of occasion there where when you read the story of how someone got enlightened, sometimes they'll say, it was like I was always usually, you know, practicing or whatever, but they go out and they say there was an experience that brought about enlightenment. Some might say, I saw an old pine tree preaching wisdom. Yeah? Something apparently, or that there's another very famous one. You know, the first I saw trees and lakes and mountains. And then there were no trees and lakes and mountains. And then there were trees and lakes and mountains. You know, it's like that. I think, again, it's that Nagarjuna, he was pointing out that although kind of the philosophy and the views are useful, if we cling on to the views as in some way ultimately or inherently existing in themselves, they cease to become medicine and turn into poison. Because we become addicted to the idea that there's going to be someone, you know, I can keep going around the world but judging people's levels of enlightenment by how good the words sound and how it holds up intellectually, and that someday I'm going to find somebody that's going to say the thing that's, yes, that's perfect, I get it. It's not going to happen. Usually the people who formulated the words or said them were quite clear about what they meant or intended by them. But we get confused in trying to understand them, usually by kind of forgetting that what the people are doing is not saying, here you are, it's all in here. It's saying, this is a signpost. You want to go to Edinburgh? It's this way. If I take the signpost, am I in Edinburgh? No. That way, however many metres or miles, and it's called the A402, whatever it is. You see, don't mistake the map for the territory or the signpost for the place. Whereas we want to say, oh, it must be in there then, or that's enough. Yeah, it's like, I think what you were saying, that's really kind of important, that go back to form is emptiness, emptiness is form, Form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form. It's not as if there's the appearance and some transcendental reality behind it,
yeah,
spatially. And Sokhi Rinpoche, again, was just really brilliant on that, because it wasn't somebody, you know, I was there, and it wasn't a student saying, I can't let go of this, you know, to go to here or whatever. But she was experiencing it emotionally. So she got to a point where she's saying, well, I can see I've got to let go of this idea, yeah? But if I let go, I feel as if I'm going, you know, just falling into a huge void, that nothing. And he said, oh, that's kind of bad. He said, what does it actually feel like? What's the feeling like? And she said, oh, it's like being on the top of a really tall building or up a mountain and falling off. Mm-hmm. He said, oh, it's very bad news. He said, good news is there is no floor. Yeah. And I thought, wow, that's a stunner. Lama Yeshe had a really beautiful one that people, he said it, and people were ever saying, well, what's the answer? And he's saying, well, I'm not, there isn't an answer, you know, not just I'm not going to tell you, it's just a question. And his question was that got everybody going. He would say, so if you kind of think of the yourself getting enlightened. He said, at the moment of your enlightenment, what's the second moment look like? Right? And then people say, well, what is... He said, no, there isn't an answer. It's just a question I ask. If you're enlightened, what's the second moment of enlightenment look like? Yeah. And then there's another one, which is, you know, really right back to the Pali words of the Buddha, is if enlightenment is a thing that we start from an unenlightened position and then work towards and achieve or get, what's the problem with that?
It'll change.
Huh?
It'll be impermanent.
If you can obtain it, but more importantly, if you can obtain it, what's the other side of the coin? You can lose it.
Yeah.
So if somebody talks about an enlightenment that they can attain or get hold of, mm-hmm, it's like a litmus test. Can't be enlightenment, can it? Mm. It's just another impermanent, transient phenomena with a beginning, a middle and an end. That's why, although people are loose, why I prefer the realize language. You don't achieve enlightenment, you don't attain it, you realize it. It depends on your model. Because you could say, you remember what I was talking about, you have everybody has Buddha nature, which you can see as seed or a potential that you create the causes and conditions for, and then it kind of develops and grows, yeah, to its full potential. There's another view that says, well, actually, no, it might be the case that we're already fully enlightened, and by doing the work, by doing the practice, by removing obscurations, by doing the purification, we just reveal what's already there. Yeah. So, in that way, it's not something that we do or achieve or attain. You know, we can create the causes and conditions for it to manifest or to be realized, but we don't kind of create it. And I kind of, both models are helpful at different times and from different perspectives, but I kind of have a marginal preference for the discovery model, because it means my illusion of an inherently existing I can't get its hands on it. It's not something that I do.
And that's state.
That one for me is really important. Otherwise, it's just another thing. And how else am I going to protect myself against the illusion of thinking I'm enlightened? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Because
in this sense, the you know, that which is sucked into and buys the illusion of the inherently existent I, because so much is invested in it, doesn't want to give that up. So it might go along with us practicing to be enlightened as long as it can get its hands on it, and it doesn't mean it's going to have to disappear. So in that way, it can be tricky, and we do have to work skillfully with it. So that's why I have a marginal preference for the discovery model. But the danger with the discovery model is that lazy people think, oh, there's nothing to do then. I'm already enlightened. Sooner or later, the veils will fall, you know. But anyway, that's why I prefer it. So, I agree. If sometimes working that way, you just end up with a contraption or a contrivance that you've made that's not really authentic. There's things to do. We can continue anytime, but that's.